Simone Professor. I enjoyed tutoring in the early days, and I think I was adequately good at it. The senior tutor of New College, in a piece of ingenious statistical research during my time, unearthed the fact that New College biology students were significantly more likely to win first-class degrees than biology students in the university as a whole. Can my teaching take some credit for that? I can't be sure, though few things would give me greater pleasure than to think so. In those early days, I still had the enthusiasm of youth, and I really cared about imparting understanding to my students, not just knowledge, but understanding. I enjoy explaining things, and the experience of tutoring perhaps honed in me certain skills in the art of explanation, to students of less as well as more ability, which later helped me in writing my books. But I cannot deny that by the time I reached my 50s and had clocked up more than 600 hours of one-on-one tutoring, I had begun to feel a little jaded. I probably wasn't as good as I should have been, probably not as good as I had been earlier. I was doing my best, but I still had some 15 years to run until I reached retirement age, and I increasingly wondered whether New College biology tutoring might benefit from new blood. At the same time, I had the positive feeling I might leave the world a better place if I devoted my remaining working life to explaining things to a wider public outside the walls of Oxford. How could I achieve that? I started to think along the following lines. My books were bestsellers. Whether or not I was any good as a lecturer to Oxford students, I was in demand as a lecturer around the world. I'd had some experience of television and journalism. Various people made me aware that I had enterprising, entrepreneurial, well, rich, readers, some of whom were enthusiastic enough to be called fans. Oxford, like all universities, was by then heavily involved in fundraising, and it had set up a branch development office in New York. It was suggested to me that Oxford's professional fundraisers, perhaps especially the American office, might do well to go out in search of a benefactor to endow a new Professorship of Public Understanding of Science, with me as the incumbent. With the support of Sir Richard Southwood, Oxford's Vice-Chancellor, whom I knew because he was also the Lineker Professor of Zoology, I attended various planning meetings to discuss the possibility with officials in the Oxford Development Office. They handed the assignment over to their New York branch, and I temporarily forgot about it and carried on with my duties. The initiative was now with Michael Cunningham of the New York office. I told him that, as a fellow guest at the Connecticut farm of my literary agent John Brockman, I had met Nathan Mervold, who had since become Microsoft's chief technology officer. Michael got in touch with Nathan and arranged a meeting between the three of us in New York. Nathan took on board the idea of finding a benefactor for Oxford's proposed Chair of Public Understanding of Science, and went away to discuss it with some of his friends at Microsoft. Among these was Charles Simone. Charles Simone is a Hungarian-American software pioneer. A brilliant software designer, he had been one of that charmed circle that came together at Xerox Park, where the modern personal computer with its WIMP interface was conceived. He was recruited to Microsoft as early as 1981, where he advocated the object-oriented programming developed at Xerox Park and his own Hungarian notation for programmers, whose ingenuity intrigues me, although I haven't used it myself. He was the supervising architect of the original Microsoft Office software suite. As an early investor in Microsoft, he grew wealthy from the growth of his shares in the company over a long period. Nathan reported to Michael that Charles was tentatively interested in the Oxford idea and wanted to meet me to discuss it. So it was that in the spring of 1995, Lala and I flew to Seattle, where we were joined by Michael Cunningham, who came in from New York. Charles put us up in a nice waterfront hotel, and we prepared for the ordeal of the evening, a dinner in a Seattle restaurant for about 50 of Charles's guests. I say ordeal only because it was clearly going to be my audition, to quote Lala's thespian simile, for the part. Charles arranged the dinner's seating plan with great care, including a remove halfway through the evening to an equally carefully crafted second configuration. Oxford colleges occasionally do the same thing, but only at very formal dinners, with a dessert course after dinner. I sat on in the same place all the other guests moved. For the first half, I was placed next to Bill Gates. No surprise that he turned out to be highly intelligent and very interesting, but the same seemed to be true of most of the other guests. This became alarmingly evident when Charles called on me to speak, and then to answer questions from anybody in the room. I have fielded questions from university audiences all over the world, including Cambridge, Oxford, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Berkeley, and Stanford, and I declare I've never been grilled so penetratingly as by that mostly quite young audience from Seattle and Silicon Valley. High-tech digerati, entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, computer pioneers, and biotechnologists. Somehow I managed to answer all their questions, even those from one guest who seemed critical to the point of heckling, and I ended the evening feeling it had gone reasonably well. The next day we were to spend with Charles, getting to know each other. Lala and I met him and his friend Angela Siddle, and Charles drove us to one of Seattle's airfields, where we boarded his helicopter, together with a professional pilot who, with Charles under his instruction, flew us north up Puget Sound, towards but not into Canada. We landed on an island for lunch and had the rare treat of seeing a bald eagle through the restaurant window. On the return journey, the dreamlike atmosphere continued as we dodged and danced among the skyscrapers of downtown Seattle. From the airfield, Charles drove us back to the hotel, where he had a 10-minute meeting closeted with Michael Cunningham. Charles and Angela then left, and Michael emerged to tell Lala and me that the deal was done. The Charles Simony Professorship of Public Understanding of Science was really going to happen, give or take some details, which would be sorted out with Oxford. One of the details was that, although Charles had endowed a full professorship, I would have to be appointed initially at the same rank as I already was, namely reader. This was because Oxford has a strict rule against benefactions buying promotion for named individuals, a scrupulous and sensible safeguard against rich uncles buying preferment, simony, as Charles himself later punned on his own name. So I was not initially promoted. I stayed at the rank of reader and actually took a slight cut in salary. A year later, I was promoted to professor on merit, my qualifications being scrutinised on the same objective basis as anybody else's. So I actually became the Simony professor a year after my original appointment as Simony reader. My successors will all be appointed Simony professor from the outset. Successors? Yes, because Charles graciously agreed to endow the professorship in perpetuity. That is to say, instead of giving only enough money to last until I reached retirement age, which was all that the original proposal had dared to suggest, he would donate a capital sum to be invested by Oxford, the annual income from which would pay not only my salary and expenses, but those of a series of successors into the indefinite future. That itself was splendidly generous, but Charles added to his magnanimity an imaginative vision, which I dare say is quite rare in major benefactors. He wrote what amounted to a far-sighted manifesto to accompany his gift. The gist was that he was looking to the distant future, and therefore he would avowedly not try to specify exactly how the terms of his benefaction should be interpreted in centuries to come. He explicitly eschewed legal red tape, saying in effect, "Future centuries will inevitably be different, and we can't predict how. I trust you, future generations at Oxford, to interpret the spirit of what I'm trying to achieve in public understanding of science, in the light of your own times." In Charles's own words, this is where we were in 1995. This was the kernel of agreement between me, between the university, and between Prof. Richard Dawkins, the first occupant of the chair. Deviate from this point if you must, but do it knowingly. Return to it if you can. Here in full is the text of Dr. Simony's trusting and blessedly unlawyered-up missive to the future. "And if future generations at Oxford betray his trust, may my ghost come back to haunt them. Or, to put the same thought in more practical terms, I hope that printing his manifesto, in what I hope and intend will be a permanent book, will make it very hard for anyone to betray it." La, tu ne cord e beauté, lux calm e volupte. Baudelaire. Since I am a computer scientist, it seems appropriate that the present description of my intentions to create a chair in public understanding of science at Oxford University should be called a program. Just as a computer program sets the processor on an inexorable future course, shouldn't this program guide the chair's appointing committee for generations to come? Quite evidently, the metaphor is weak. Administrative affairs being as they are, I can only vainly hope that the distinguished committee members will take my comments to heart before deciding on a new appointment. Yet I begrudge by no means the uncertainty and flexibility that is built into the appointments process so that the university can adapt, evolve, and flourish. This flexibility can be used for experimentation and exploration of new arrangements, but over time it can also result in an accumulating creep or drift in direction that may not even be noticed. The purpose of this program is then to be a fixed navigation point on the sea of possibilities. It says, this is where we were in 1995, this was the kernel of agreement between me, between the university, and between Prof. Richard Dawkins, the first occupant of the chair. Deviate from this point if you must, but do it knowingly. Return to it if you can. The chair is for public understanding of science. That is, the holder will be expected to make important contributions to the public's understanding of some scientific field, rather than study the public's perception of the same. By public, we mean the largest possible audience, provided, however, that people who have the power and ability to propagate or oppose the ideas, especially scholars in other sciences and in humanities, engineers, business people, journalists, politicians, professionals, and artists, are not lost in the process. Here it is useful to distinguish between the roles of scholars and popularizers. The university chair is intended for accomplished scholars who have made original contributions to their field and who are able to grasp the subject, when necessary, at the highest levels of abstraction. A popularizer, on the other hand, focuses mainly on the size of the audience and frequently gets separated from the world of scholarship. Popularizers often write on immediate concerns or even fads. In some cases, they seduced less educated audiences by offering a patronizingly oversimplified or exaggerated view of the state of the art or the scientific process itself. This is best seen in hindsight, as we remember the giant brains computer books of yesteryear, but I suspect many current science books will in time be recognized as having fallen into this category. While the role of popularizer may still be valuable, nevertheless it is not one supported by this chair. The public's expectation of scholars is high, and it is only fitting that we have a high expectation of the public. Understanding in this instance should be taken a little poetically as well as literally. The goal is for the public to appreciate the order and beauty of the abstract and natural worlds which is there, hidden, layer upon layer. To share the excitement and awe that scientists feel when confronting the greatest of riddles. To have empathy for the scientists who are humbled by the grandeur of it all. Those in the audience who reach the understanding sufficient to reveal the order and beauty in science will also gain greater insight into the connectedness of science and their everyday life. Finally, science here means not only the natural and mathematical sciences, but also the history of science and the philosophy of science as well. However, preference should be given to specialities which express or achieve their results mainly by symbolic manipulation, such as particle physics, molecular biology, cosmology, genetics, computer science, linguistics, brain research, and, of course, mathematics. The reason for this is more than a personal predilection. Symbolic expression enables the highest degree of abstraction, and thence the utilization of powerful mathematical and data processing tools ensures tremendous progress. At the same time, the very means of success tends to isolate the scientist from the lay audience and prevents the communication of the results. Considering the profoundly vital interdependence between the society at large and the scientific world, the dearth of effective information flow is positively dangerous. In order to accomplish the above goals, the appointees to the chair must have a pedagogical range that goes beyond the traditional university setting. They should be able to communicate effectively with audiences of all kinds and in different media. Above all, they must approach the public with the utmost candor. Naturally, they will interact with political, religious, and other societal forces, but they must not, under any circumstances, let these forces affect the scientific validity of what they say. Conversely, they should be also candid about the limits of scientific knowledge at any given time and communicate the uncertainties, frustrations, scientifically perplexing phenomena, and even the failures in their area of expertise. Scientific speculation, when so labelled, and when the concept of speculation and its place in the scientific method has been made clear to the audience, can be very exciting. It is a very effective communication tool, and it is by no means discouraged. We recognise that persons with those combined qualifications are rare. Therefore, the preferences listed above for particular scientific specialities should be taken secondary to the appointee's pedagogical and communication talents. The appointees should have the opportunity to continue their scientific work. This is best accomplished if their appointment in the department closest to their field would be held jointly with the Department of Continuing Education. While being firmly based in Oxford, the appointees should receive every possible support from the university for travel and for visiting professorships. In accordance with this, their teaching and administrative responsibilities within Oxford should be correspondingly limited and should be directed primarily towards the education of non-specialists. They would be expected to write books and magazine articles in any medium for the popular as well as scientific audiences, participate in public lectures, whether through the university or otherwise, and generally participate in the expression of the public understanding of science. There is always a potential danger that a benefaction can prove counterproductive if the first holder's previous post is not filled when he or she vacates it. I make this gift on the assumption that Richard Dawkins's existing post in the Department of Zoology will be filled in a similar field as a matter of routine when he vacates it. I gratefully acknowledge the contribution from Prof. Dawkins, who provided me with a framework for the present programme. Charles Simoni, Bellevue, 15th of May, 1995. Obviously, the members of the appointment boards for all future Simoni professors must read his letter in full, and it should be in front of each one of them around the committee table. But I would call attention especially to a number of points. He makes the distinction between popularisers of science and scientists with original scientific contributions to their credit who also popularise. He interprets understanding of science a little poetically. He wrote the letter 3 years before I published Unweaving the Rainbow, and I like to think that when that book finally appeared, he found it resonant with his wish. My preface to that book contains a tribute to him as a Renaissance man with an imaginative vision of science and how it should be communicated. I explained how we had talked over these matters since becoming friends, and I offered Unweaving the Rainbow as my written contribution to the conversation and as my inaugural statement as Simoni Professor. In an especially telling passage of his manifesto, Charles urges future Simoni professors to be candid about the limitations of science, while never allowing religious or political forces to affect the scientific validity of what they say. Finally, a more short-term but important point, Charles realised that his gift might backfire if I was simply moved sideways and my lecturing position in zoology lost. One of my motivations in seeking the move was specifically so that I might be replaced by new blood, bringing fresh enthusiasm to Oxford zoology, even as I carried my own renewed enthusiasm to the world outside. I was indeed replaced by a succession of excellent younger zoologists, David Goldstein, Eddie Holmes, Oliver Pybus, each of whom soon went on to a prestigious professorship, and now the wonderful Ashley Griffin, who I hope will be with us a long time before the same happens to her. Simoni Lectures. One of the first things I did as Simoni Professor was to endow in a much smaller way with my own money from book royalties an annual Charles Simoni Lecture in Oxford. In accordance with Charles's manifesto, the lecturers I invited have all been distinguished scholars in their own right and have all been successful in increasing the public understanding of science. I'm proud to say it is a pretty starry list. Here they are with the titles of their lectures. 1999, Daniel Dennett, The Evolution of Culture. 2000, Richard Gregory, Shaking Hands with the Universe. 2001, Jared Diamond, Why Did Human History Unfold Differently on Different Continents? 2002, Steven Pinker, The Blank Slate. 2003, Martin Rees, The Mystery of Our Complex Cosmos. 2004, Richard Leakey, Why Our Origins Matter. 2005, Carolyn Porco, In Orbit, Cassini Explores the Saturn System. 2006, Harry Kroto, Can the Internet Save the Enlightenment? 2007, Paul Nurse, The Great Ideas of Biology. Finally, in 2008, the year of my retirement, I gave the 10th Simonia Lecture myself, my valedictory swan song, with the title The Purpose of Purpose. A high point of that same year, incidentally, was the wonderful retirement dinner that the Vice-Chancellor, John Hood, arranged for me in the University Museum, with a guest list every bit as distinguished as that for my 70th birthday dinner 3 years later. Except for the first two, which took place in the zoology department, all the Simonia lectures were in the comfortable and stylish surroundings of the Oxford Playhouse. The enlightened managers of the Playhouse were keen to promote science as well as drama. I've already mentioned that they put on Michael Frayn's important play Copenhagen about the enigma of Werner Heisenberg's wartime visit to Niels Bohr, and that afterwards they invited Oxford physicists to a question-and-answer session with Michael Frayn himself. Michael told Lala and me afterwards that he found this quite a testing experience, but I thought he handled it extremely well, and so did distinguished physicists that I spoke to, for example, Sir Roger Penrose and Sir Roger Elliot. The Heisenberg-Bohr meeting, if I may digress again, is of historic importance because of the enigma of Germany's failure to develop an atomic bomb. If anyone could have led such a project, it would have been Heisenberg. When he miscalculated that it couldn't realistically be done, was it a deliberate mistake? To think so would be a tribute to his memory, but unfortunately the answer is probably no, as I first learned from Roger Elliot's predecessor as Wickham Professor of Physics, Sir Rudolf Piles, my senior colleague at New College. Piles was one of the two British physicists, both Jewish refugees from Hitler, who first correctly calculated that an atomic superbomb was possible, and alerted the Allies to that fact, the Frisch-Piles Memorandum. In his aged widowerhood, Sir Rudolf invited Lala and me to a large dinner party in his Oxford flat, for which he did the cooking entirely by himself. When all the other guests had left, we stayed to help wash the dishes, and he told us the story of Heisenberg's apparently sincere, secretly recorded, astonishment on first learning the news of Hiroshima. Also, while washing the dishes, we were fascinated to hear of the ingenuity by which Sir Rudolf had earlier guessed that the Germans were not putting any serious effort into an atom bomb project. Knowing the world of German physics intimately, he carefully examined university lecture lists and noted that Professor this, Professor von that, and Doctor the other were all still giving their lectures in their respective universities at a time when they would surely have been seconded to an equivalent of the Manhattan Project, if such existed. Lovely piece of detective work. And he was a lovely man who, after the war, struggled, like Robert Oppenheimer, to reduce the dangers of the terrible weapons they had helped to create, becoming a prominent member of the Pugwash movement for world peace. I attended his funeral in 1995 and was sorry he was not around to give a Simonia lecture, for he had a great interest in public understanding of science and presented me with a signed copy of his book, The Laws of Nature, which explains physics to people like me. Each of the Simonia lectures was followed by a dinner for about 16 people, usually in New College, but on two occasions in the timelessly beautiful Whiteham Abbey, just outside Oxford, through the kindness of its owners, Michael and Martine Stewart, who also graced the table with their own lively company. Charles himself flew in, piloted his jet into Oxford's tiny airport, for several of the lectures. It was at one of these post-lecture dinners that Charles presented me with one of my most treasured possessions, a first edition Origin of Species, one of the original print run of only 1,250. I was tongue-tied with emotion when he stood up and made a gracious speech as he presented it to me. It is a privilege to have known all nine of my Simonia lecturers. I first became aware of Dan Dennett when he and his colleague Douglas Hofstadter invited a chapter of The Selfish Gene, the meme chapter, into their thought-provoking anthology, The Mind's Eye. The anthology also includes the text of Dan's own Where Am I?, a tour de force of a lecture in which he pretended that his brain, Yorick, was secured on a life support system in a vat, communicating with his body by radio and running in perfect synchrony with an exact copy, Hubert, downloaded into a computer. It made no difference which of the two brains controlled his body. So confident was he of their interchangeability that, as his climax to the lecture, he switched from one to the other, with dramatically hammed-up results that fully justified the standing ovation I have no doubt the lecture received. The Where Am I lecture is one of those philosophical works, indeed Dan is one of those philosophers, along with A.C. Grayling, Jonathan Glover and Rebecca Goldstein, that enable me, and I think many scientists, to get what philosophers can be good for. His thinking has a high-spirited, teasing quality, as well as great depth, and he is one of that new breed of philosophers of science who are knowledgeable about science and able to talk on equal terms to leading scientists about their own field. He is a warmly sympathetic friend and the sort of conversationalist who raises the game of whoever he is talking to. When I have a conversation with Dan, I can almost feel my intelligence quotient rising towards, though never reaching, his. This raising the game is a curious ability, rare but not unknown in others, for example Steven Pinker, to pick a further name from my list of Simony lecturers, and it might repay research by education theorists. The late Bernard Williams, another distinguished philosopher who became a friend, together with his sweet wife Patricia, had a similar effect, but in his case he seemed to make his companion become wittier and more amusing. So does the literary scholar and biographer Hermione Lee, another new college colleague, now president of Woolston College, Oxford, and still a good, though now less often seen, friend. I don't know where the phrase raise one's game comes from, but it is apt to all these people. As I shall mention in the memes section of the next chapter, Dan Dennett is one of those, another is the briskly intelligent psychologist Susan Blackmore, author of The Meme Machine, who has taken the idea of memes and run with it. Memes play a significant role in several of Dan's books, including Darwin's Dangerous Idea, Consciousness Explained, and Breaking the Spell, among others. He is an evocative phrase-maker with a bulging quiverful of intuition pumps, to quote the title of another of his books, itself an intuition pump in its own right. Cranes and skyhooks are among my favourites. He is also a devastating deflator of obscurantism and pretentious deepities, his excellent coining, which could be defined ostensibly as almost anything ever said by Deepak Chopra, Karen Armstrong, or Teilhard de Chardin. Years after Dan's Simony lecture, I was with John Brockman in New York, and John confided to a group of us that Dan had suddenly been taken dangerously ill. The prognosis was dire, and we, his friends, had already prepared ourselves to mourn when the news began to get slightly better. Dan was saved by heroic American medicine and state-of-the-art heart surgery. While recuperating in hospital, he wrote a deeply moving article called Thank Goodness. The contrast with the conventional Thank God was calculated. He was thanking the goodness of the team of surgeons and doctors, the nurses, the inventors of the advanced scientific equipment that enabled them to diagnose and treat him, even the launderers of his bloody sheets. With gentle sarcasm, he mocked those who had written to say they were praying for him. And did you also sacrifice a goat? Read his paper. It is an exultant heart cry of gratitude to recipients who really deserve gratitude and who really exist. Richard Gregory died in 2010, a great loss to our shared enterprise of raising public appreciation of science. He was a psychologist specialising in visual illusions as a window shining light into the workings of the mind, but he combined his psychology with the skills and intuitions of an inventive engineer, and he also had a deep knowledge of the history of science. He pioneered the style of hands-on science museum that became well known through his own exploratory at Bristol and the Exploratorium in San Francisco. His personal manner was one of joyous hopping about enthusiasm. When explaining a favourite piece of science, he almost seemed to dance on the spot, chortling with joy like a big schoolboy bursting with excitement as he unwraps a new toy for Christmas. He greatly appreciated his election as a Fellow of the Royal Society, and he made a point of writing me a kindly glowing letter when I myself received the same honour much later. It's much more fun being in than out. I first met Richard when he came to give a talk in Oxford while I was a graduate student. As an afterthought to his psychology lecture, in response to a question, he described his wickedly ingenious invention of an attachment to an astronomical telescope. The idea, now superseded by the computer equivalent of the same trick, was a cunning technique of taking photographs through previously exposed photographic negatives in order to average out the random noise of interference in the upper atmosphere. I next met him when he was again visiting Oxford, and Lala and I invited him to dinner in our flat, together with Francis Crick and his wife Odile, who took the photograph that appears in the E appendix. It was a great privilege for Lala and me to have these two intellectual giants at our table and hear them spark off each other, a kind of forerunner of what I would later call a mutual tutorial. I just mentioned Sue Blackmore, and I'm reminded of her affectionate obituary of Richard Gregory, which captures the man beautifully. She describes her own first meeting with him in his Bristol lab in 1978, and her memory of a whirlwind tour of an early flight simulator made of plaster and bits of wood, a 3D drawing machine with metal arms and joints, and a spinning bowl of mercury, which he was hoping to use as some kind of reflecting telescope. Imagine that being allowed today. "Isn't this fun?" Gregory would gasp as he went from one quirky and interesting question to another. There will never be anyone quite as wacky, inventive, eclectic, brilliant, or engaging as Gregory, but I hope there'll be many more scientists who have his playful curiosity, his delight in science, and whose enthusiasm can survive our current culture of targets, measurement, and obsession with usefulness. The title of his Simony lecture, Shaking Hands with the Universe, was, of course, a reference to his hands-on approach, and his lecture was a feast of vivid demonstrations. I first met Jared Diamond in 1987 in Los Angeles. I was spending 2 weeks there, working intensively as a guest in Alan Kay's research offshoot of the Apple Computer Company, writing the color version of my Blind Watchmaker Biomorphs program. The working atmosphere was ideal. I shared an open-plan office with clever young programmers and could turn to them at any time for advice on the recondite inner workings of the Mac toolbox. Even better was my living environment as a houseguest of the delightful Gwen Roberts, mathematics teacher and puzzler extraordinaire, as one of her motley but intriguing population of migrant visitors. A quirkily entertaining companion, if she were an author, she would have a most exotic pulver batch. Google it together with Douglas Adams. Every morning I commuted by bus from Gwen's house to the office and usually had lunch with the geeks, sandwiches for which they sent out to a neighbouring deli. On one of these days, however, I was invited out to lunch by a UCLA professor whose name was prominent in my field of biology, but whom I had not so far met, Jared Diamond. We agreed that he would pick me up in his car outside the Apple office. His books were bestsellers, and so, as I stood on the corner, I was looking out for something exuding quiet luxury, prosperous if not flash. I didn't give a second glance at the ancient Volkswagen Beetle that chugged and lurched slowly and erratically towards me from far along the dead straight road, until it creaked to a halt, and there was the smiling Dr. Diamond. I got in, dodging the curtain of upholstery that had come unglued and was hanging loose from the car's ceiling. I hadn't known quite what kind of restaurant he would take me to. Perhaps the charming Volkswagen should have given me a clue. We parked the Beetle on the UCLA campus and walked to a cool, grassy bank by a stream, gently shaded by trees. Here we sat on the grass, and Jared produced lunch, wrapped in a large cloth, a hunk of cheese and some crusty bread, which he cut with a Swiss Army knife. Perfect. So much more conducive to interesting conversation than a noisy restaurant, with waiters coyly informing us, "I'm Jason and I'll be your server for today," and reeling off lists of specials, then later interrupting the conversation to ask, "How's everything tasting?" And Jared's bread and cheese in those bucolic surroundings really did taste good. In English pubs, by the way, bread and cheese is called ploughman's lunch. Not an ancient name, it was presumably coined by some whiz kid in marketing. It was the subject of an amusing anachronism on The Archers, a popular soap opera on BBC Radio chronicling the lives and feuds of farming folk in a fictitious rural village. An old farmhand complained nostalgically that the ploughman's lunch he had been given in the village inn was not a patch on the ploughman's lunches of his youth in the good old days. My next encounter with Jared was in 1990 when Jim Watson, director of the Cold Spring Harbour Laboratory on Long Island, invited Jared and me to organise a conference there to celebrate the centenary of that prestigious institution. The conference was called Evolution, Molecules to Culture, but what I remember most vividly was the presence of a rather outspoken school of linguists from Russia. Jared had taken the initiative in inviting them, and I must have fondly imagined that linguists and evolutionary biologists would have much in common. Language changes gradually over historical time in a way that bears a strong, if superficial, resemblance to the way living species change over geological time. Linguists have perfected techniques for reconstructing ancient dead languages, such as Proto-Indo-European, by careful comparative analysis of their descendants, techniques that look winningly familiar to evolutionary biologists, especially molecular taxonomists, who deal in what can, in these post-Watson Crick days, be called molecular texts. Moreover, the first stirrings of linguistic capability in our hominin ancestors is a topic of great curiosity to biologists, even though some linguists have treated it as a forbidden, because intractable, one. Notoriously, in 1866, the Linguistic Society of Paris banned discussion of the question on the ground that it was forever unanswerable. Such a prohibition seems absurdly negative to me. However hard it might be to reconstruct, language clearly must have had an origin or origins. There must have been a transitional period when language evolved from our ancestors' pre-linguistic state. The transition was a real phenomenon. It rarely happened, whether the Paris Society liked it or not, and there is surely no harm in at least speculating about it. Did our ancestors pass through a stage resembling chimpanzee sign language, large vocabulary but no hierarchically nested syntax of the kind that is now unique to humans? Did the capacity for hierarchically embedded grammatical structures arise suddenly in one genius individual? If so, who did she talk to? Could it have arisen as a software tool for internal, unvoiced thoughts, becoming externalized in the form of audible language only later? Do fossils tell us anything about the range of sounds that our various ancestors were capable of uttering? These are all questions to which there has to be a definite answer, even if the answer is beyond our reach in practice, and I'll return to them in the next chapter. Jared and I had an enjoyable back-and-forth correspondence putting together the invitations to the conference, and it has to be said that most of the expertise came from him. The conference itself, when it finally happened, was the occasion for a certain bafflement on my part. I was impressed by the confidence with which the linguists claimed to reconstruct relatively recent ancestral languages such as Proto-Indo-European, circa 3500 BC. I could stomach similar reconstructions of other Ur languages such as Proto-Uralic and Proto-Altaic. By more strained analogy, I supposed that, in principle, you could feed those proto-languages back into the same reconstructive mill and come up with the Ur language to end, or rather begin, all Ur languages, Proto-Nostratic, although I gathered that even many of the linguists themselves found that a bit of a stretch. So far, so intriguing. But I came unstuck when I ventured what seemed like a pretty obvious suggestion, what is vulgarly called a no-brainer. Seeking to make a contribution as an evolutionary biologist, I proposed what I thought was a salient difference between linguistic and genetic evolution. Once a biological species has split in two, perhaps separated by an accident of geography, once the divergence has gone far enough to preclude interbreeding, it is forever. The two gene pools, previously mixed by sexual reproduction, never merge again, even if they meet. Indeed, that's how we define the separation of species. Languages, by contrast, having diverged far apart, often come together again and form gloriously rich hybrids. This would mean that, although biologists can safely trace all the surviving mammals, say, back to one single matriarchal individual who lived and died about 180 million years ago, it would not be true that all Indo-European languages trace back to a single, unique, ancestral language spoken by a particular tribe somewhere in Eastern Europe about 3.5 millennia ago. The Russian linguists were almost apoplectic in their indignation. Languages never merge! But, I stammered, what about English? Nonsense, they shot back. English is a purely Germanic language. What percentage of English words is of Romance origin? I asked. Oh, about 80%, was their unabashed, almost contemptuously paradoxical reply. I sank back into my biologist's shell, crushed but unsatisfied. I think the conference was a success, and Jared and I were both pleased with it. When he came to Oxford to give his Simonia lecture, he was a most gracious guest. Belying, or no, maybe in accordance with, his bread-and-cheese lunch, he showed an appreciation for the finer things in life when he presented Lala and me with a good vintage Napa Valley Cabernet Sauvignon, and carefully wrote on the bottle that it should be drunk between 2005 and 2017. We shall open it to celebrate the publication of this book in 2015. In addition to being a distinguished physiologist, ornithologist and ecologist, he is a widely cultivated man, a polyglot, deeply knowledgeable about anthropology and world history, and we benefited from this in his Simone lecture, which was centred on his book, Guns, Germs and Steel. It is a tour de force, and one cannot help wondering why no historian ever got around to writing it before him. Why did it take a scientist to develop its fascinating historical thesis? One could make the same point, perhaps even more forcefully, about The Better Angels of Our Nature by the next of my Simone lecturers, Steven Pinker. Apart from reading Chomsky himself and one or two other books when I was teaching myself to write a grammar-generating computer program, most of what I know about linguistics comes from Steven Pinker. The same is true for much of what I know about modern cognitive psychology and the history of human violence. Steve Pinker and I are among the handful of scientists in the world, along with Jim Watson and Craig Venter, who have had our genome sequenced in their entirety. Steve's genes suggest that he should have high intelligence, no surprise there, but also, amusingly, look at any photo of him on the internet, that he ought to be bald. It's an important lesson to learn. The known effects of genes in many cases only slightly change the statistical probability of a particular outcome. With conspicuous exceptions like Huntington's disease, they don't determine it with high probability, but interact with many other factors, including lots of other genes. It's especially important to remember this when dealing with genes for diseases. People are sometimes frightened to look at their genome for fear it will tell them exactly when and how they will die, a kind of death sentence. If that were a realistic fear, identical twins would die simultaneously. As psychologists go, Steve has a reputation for veering slightly towards the nativist wing, but that really means only that he is not part of the extreme environmentalism that characterised some schools of academic psychology and social science through much of the 20th century. This comes through in his book, The Blank Slate, which was also the title of his Simone lecture in 2002. He is a leader of the growing, but still somewhat beleaguered, school of evolutionary psychologists, a stance that has made him strangely unpopular among some psychologists and philosophers, including, even more strangely, the late Bernard Williams, who was in other respects extremely reasonable. As I mentioned in the previous chapter, the Atheist Alliance International honoured me in 2003 by instituting the Richard Dawkins Award, given each year to an individual for raising public consciousness of atheism. Since 2011, after the AAI spun off two daughter societies, the award has been given by the Atheist Alliance of America. The recipient is chosen by a committee in which I play no part, but I usually make an effort to present the prize personally during the annual conference of the Alliance. In those years when I haven't been able to travel, I've videotaped a speech. The full text of my speech for Steve Pinker, the 2013 winner, is in the E-Appendix. Here I will confine myself to reproducing the opening and closing paragraphs. Newspapers and magazines frequently publish ranked lists of public intellectuals throughout the world. Steven Pinker is always near the top of such lists, and rightly so. I think he'd probably be top of my world list, and I'm truly delighted that he is being given this award in my name. Wonderfully readable, he introduces non-specialist readers to his own specialist subject. He's not the only person to do that, although he does it superlatively well. But what is truly remarkable is that he does it for several different subjects, and unlike a science journalist, he is a genuine world-class expert in all the subjects he writes about. His scholarship is as deep as his writing style is gripping. I went on to give a brief account of his various books, and then concluded, "After achieving so much, you might have expected him to rest on his very considerable laurels. And now that I think about it, a laurel wreath would look quite becoming on the famous coiffure." But resting on his laurels was exactly what Steve didn't do. He produced what can only be described as a magnum opus, and he did it by moving into a completely new field, namely history. The Better Angels of Our Nature is a magisterial work of history, but it is unmistakably the work of a scientist, and a scientist at the height of his powers. The Better Angels of Our Nature is not just a scholarly tour de force, it is a document of hope and optimism. Hope and optimism are much needed today, and that very fact should make us suspicious of anyone who steps up to offer them. But our suspicion is battered into submission by the sheer weight of scholarship. And if weight of scholarship suggests heavy going, that is exactly wrong. The book is light and easy reading. Good company, witty and amusing, like its author. I am humbled and honoured that the Atheist Alliance has chosen so illustrious a scholar and my personal hero for the award in my name. Where British science is concerned, Martin Rees pretty much is the great and the good. Astronomer Royal, President of the Royal Society, master of the largest, richest and arguably most distinguished, certainly most distinguished in science, of all the colleges of Cambridge or Oxford, knighted, raised to the peerage, and Templeton Prize winner. Aye, there's the rub, for in that dream of spiritual dimension, what corruption of true science may come. In its early years, the Templeton Prize, pegged by its naively benevolent founder to exceed the Nobel in monetary, though of course no other value, was awarded to frankly religious figures such as Mother Teresa and Billy Graham. A little later, the black spot moved on to scientists of no great distinction, but who happened to be openly devout. As an exact reversal, yet more recent prize winners have included scientists of genuine and enormous distinction, not really religious at all, but willing to utter the occasional spiritual deepity and therefore sprinkle on religion some of the gold dust of true science. Freeman Dyson and Martin Rees are the prime examples. What is the next Faustian progression? Notorious atheists prepared to stage a Damascene conversion? Dan Dennett, begetter of the excellent deepity coinage itself, might seem to be a prime candidate, or, as he himself said to me, Richard, if ever you fall on hard times... The greater you are as a scientist, the greater the danger that Templeton can exploit you. Martin Rees is a truly great scientist, as well as a good and exceptionally nice man, and I want to apologise if any of my negativity towards Templeton, either here or in the past, has seemed to be aimed at him personally. I have the very highest regard for him, and I can see exactly why Templeton would seek to recruit such a bright star to burnish its shabby image. Martin Rees is not just a great scientist, he's also a great communicator of his science, no easy task where cosmology is concerned. Cosmologists really do have to grapple with some of the deepest questions any scientist faces, and Martin manages to make it clear without dumbing down, fascinating without selling out to demotic populism. His Simonia lecture was a model of how to deal with the deep problems of existence simply but not simplistically. His title, The Mystery of Our Complex Cosmos, led him to elucidate what he meant by complexity, illustrating it with a lovely image. Stars are vast, but a star is much simpler than a butterfly. He was rightly firm about the entitlement of science, as opposed to metaphysics, to ask speculative questions about, for instance, the likelihood of finding bio-friendly planets in the universe, and even bio-friendly universes in a multiverse of billions of universes, an idea he had beautifully explored in just six numbers. To quote his lecture, this is not metaphysics but science, albeit speculative science. I first met Richard Leakey when he wrote me a somewhat unusual letter. He had a charitable interest in a London college of which he was a trustee, and he was trying to persuade a rich man from America to come through with a big donation. The would-be benefactor had read my books and expressed a wish to meet me. Richard wrote to ask whether I would have lunch with the two of them in an Oxford restaurant. I said I would, mostly because I wanted to meet Richard Leakey. Both men were, in their different ways, larger-than-life figures. Our host turned out to be a polymathic and prolific talker of strong and decisive will, who went some way towards living up to his preferred nickname of Philosopher King. When we had ordered our meals, he handed the wine list to Richard and unsuspectingly invited him to choose the wine. Did a wicked smile cross Richard's lips as he scanned the list, exchanged a quiet word with the sommelier, and handed it back? If it did, I didn't notice. The meal was convivial, and the wine was excellent, as indeed it had every right to be, and thereby hangs this tale. But I knew nothing of it until the waiter gave the Philosopher King the bill. His face went white and his jaw dropped, but he paid without a word. At the time I didn't know what the problem was, but Richard told me afterwards in high merriment. His whispered instruction to the wine waiter had been to fetch a bottle costing more than £200. Not, you might think, the best way to endear yourself to a man from whom you're hoping to raise a large charitable benefaction. I believe the mot juste is chutzpah, and that's Richard all over, as I later came to appreciate. For all I know, he may even have got away with it. The next time I met him was at another lunch, this time a celebratory lunch of the Science Masters series, initiated by John Brockman and Anthony Cheatham, in which he and I both had slim volumes, River Out of Eden in my case, the excellent The Origin of Humankind in his. Lala happened to sit next to him at the lunch, and they got on so well that he invited her, and incidentally me, to spend Christmas with his family in Kenya, at their house on the Indian Ocean coast. We went, and the encounter reminded us again of his darkly humorous indomitability. Here is what I wrote of him after that Christmas visit in the Sunday Times, repeated in A Devil's Chaplain, in the section called All Africa and Her Prodigies. Richard Leakey is a robust hero of a man who actually lives up to the cliché, a big man in every sense of the word. Like other big men, he is loved by many, feared by some, and not over preoccupied with the judgments of any. He lost both legs in a near-fatal air crash in 1994, at the end of his rampantly successful years crusading against poachers. As director of the Kenya Wildlife Service, he transformed the previously demoralised rangers into a crack fighting army with modern weapons to match those of the poachers, and more importantly, with an esprit de corps and a will to hit back at them. In 1989, he persuaded President Moi to light a bonfire of more than 2,000 seized tusks, a uniquely Leakeyan masterstroke of public relations that did much to destroy the ivory trade and save the elephant. But jealousies were aroused by his international prestige, which helped raise funds for his department, money that other officials coveted. Hardest to forgive, he conspicuously proved it possible to run a big department in Kenya efficiently and without corruption. Leakey had to go, and he did. Coincidentally, his plane had unexplained engine failure, and now he swings along on two artificial legs, with a spare pair with flippers specially made for swimming. He again races his sailing boat with his wife and daughters for crew. He lost no time in regaining his pilot's license, and his spirit will not be crushed. Should that coincidentally have been in quotation marks? I suppose we shall never know, but it seems odd that the near-fatal engine failure happened soon after takeoff on the very first flight after his plane had been serviced. Richard tells a lovely, if slightly macabre, story about his legs. After they were amputated in Cambridge, he wanted, for sentimental reasons, to bury them in his beloved Kenya. He had to get permission to transport them, and bureaucracy insisted that this was possible only if he could produce a death certificate. He very reasonably argued that he wasn't dead, and eventually the Dundridges saw the justice of this and agreed. They stipulated, however, that he must take them in his hand luggage. Legs may not be checked in. Richard hilariously describes the double take of the previously bored official watching the X-ray screen as the bag containing the legs went through, and his facial expression as he frantically beckoned his colleagues to come over and have a look. Richard was a natural choice for Simone lecturer, and he gave a stellar performance. As usual, it was spontaneous and without notes. In Hitchensian vein, his fluent performance was the more impressive because he arrived at the theatre directly from yet another large lunch, at the very same restaurant as the Philosopher King's, and accompanied, for all I know, by equally good wine, with another potential benefactor, this time from Holland. I first met Carolyn Porco in 1998 in Los Angeles, when we were both invited by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to a meeting of scientists and filmmakers to try to persuade Hollywood to frame science in a more sympathetic light. We were reminded that scientists in fiction, from Dr. Frankenstein to Dr. Strangelove, were typically portrayed as heartless eccentrics, gradgrinds, psychopaths or worse. A 1943 film about Marie Curie represented her as indifferent to her husband's death, whereas in fact, as one delegate said, we know from a letter that when they brought her husband's corpse in, she hurled herself at it and kissed it and cried. The film directors at our Hollywood conference included one infuriating contrarian who seemed hell-bent on wrecking the whole meeting and all it stood for. This was unfortunate, as he was powerful and influential, a well-known name in the world of television. Jim Watson lost patience and hissed a wonderfully Watsonian put-down. "Are you for real? You sound like an escapee from the Yale English department." But I was equally impressed by the insouciant disdain shown towards him by the bright, articulate, courageous and beautiful astronomer sitting next to him on the same panel, Caroline Porco. At one point she quietly whispered something to him, which prompted him to bellow to the whole audience, "Oh, so now she's calling me an asshole!" There was a lot of talk about trying to initiate a science soap opera with sympathetically portrayed scientists supplying the human interest. Caroline would have made an ideal role model for the heroine of such a drama. Indeed, one of two rumours holds that Caroline was the model for Ellie, the heroine of Carl Sagan's science fiction book Contact, the other candidate being Jill Tarter, the admirable director of SETI, The Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. My contribution to the discussion was the somewhat heretical suggestion that science is so interesting in its own right, it doesn't need the sort of human interest that a soap would provide. The New York Times reporter of the meeting quoted me as wondering why Jurassic Park had to have any people in it at all when it had dinosaurs. I've just watched that film again, and even on a small airliner screen was as enthralled as ever by the dinosaurs, but I had forgotten quite how anti-scientific its human interest message was. The concluding negativity of even the scientist characters was so untrue to life. However terrifying their experience, which included watching a lawyer being swallowed whole by a tyrannosaur, how could any scientist not remain captivated by the very idea of recovering viable dinosaur DNA from the last blood meal of a mosquito embalmed in amber? Presumably the ludicrous shoehorning in of chaos theory was in deference to the pop science flavour of the month at the time the film was being made. Nowadays the equivalent fad, enjoying its 15 minutes of pop science voguery, would be epigenetics. And no, there are some in-jokes that are best not spelled out. After our panel discussion, I made a pretty shameless point of manoeuvring to sit next to Caroline on the bus as we toured Hollywood and were shown around one of the big studios. In this legendary town of starry people, I was starstruck by a charismatic scientist, which I suppose sums up the purpose of the conference. Now that I think about it, Barbara Kingsolver's Flight Behaviour is a novel that exactly fits that same purpose, a beautiful story of scientists as sympathetic human beings and how they work and think. Hollywood, please take note. It would make a lovely film. Caroline came to visit us in Oxford, see the picture in the E appendix, and has been friends with Lala and me ever since. She is a planetary scientist in charge of NASA's Cassini imaging team, the team that has brought us those stunning pictures sent back from Saturn and its many moons. But she is more than just a good scientist. She is inspired by the poetry of science, especially the romance of the spheres that share our sun. She's the nearest approach I know to a female Carl Sagan, a poet of the planets and singer of the stars. Whether or not the heroine of the book Contact was actually modelled on her, it is a fact that Carl Sagan invited her to be the character consultant on the film version. The scene where Ellie first hears the unmistakable communication from far space still gives me goosebumps when I think of it. The slender, clever young woman, woken up by the mind-shattering signal, bouncing back to base in her open car, exultantly yelling the celestial coordinates into the intercom for her dozing assistants. Numbers, numbers, the spine-tingling poetry of those numbers and their arc-second precision. And how poetically right that the hero of the numbers should have been a woman. A role model, just like Caroline. An anecdote displays the poetry of Caroline, and I related it in the Oxford Playhouse when introducing her Simone lecture. A beloved professor from her days at Caltech was the geologist Eugene Shoemaker, co-discoverer, with his wife and David Levy, of the famous Shoemaker-Levy comet. A pioneer of astrogeology, Shoemaker was part of the Apollo space program. He was in the running to be the first geologist on the moon, but to his sad regret, had to drop out for health reasons, and he turned to training astronauts instead of being one. In 1997, Shoemaker was killed in a car crash in Australia. Caroline, in her grief, raced into action. She knew that NASA was about to launch an unmanned craft, which was programmed to crash land on the moon after its mission was accomplished. She managed to persuade the mission manager, as well as the head of the Planetary Exploration Program at NASA, to add her teacher's ashes to the spacecraft's payload. Gene Shoemaker's ambition to be an astronaut was denied him in life, but his ashes now lie on the moon's surface, where no wind stirs them. It is said that Neil Armstrong's footprints are almost certainly still intact. And with a photographic engraving bearing these words that Carolyn chose from Romeo and Juliet. "And when he shall die, take him and cut him out in little stars, and he will make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will be in love with night and pay no worship to the garish sun." I have dined out on that story from time to time, but I usually cannot manage to recite the Shakespeare and turn to Lala to rescue me. When she speaks the lines from memory in her beautiful voice, I think I'm not the only one around the table to choke up. Carolyn's Simonia lecture was, as you would expect, gorgeously illustrated, the beauty of her images matching the poetry of her words. The ovation that the Oxford audience gave her made me proud to have initiated the series and delighted that this was one that Charles himself was able to attend. I placed Carolyn next to him at the dinner, and I believe they've stayed in touch since. It is thanks to Carolyn, by the way, that asteroid 8331, a main belt asteroid discovered on the 27th of May 1982 by Shoemaker and Buss, is named Dawkins. I ended my run of Simonia lectures on a high with two Nobel Prize winners, Sir Harry Kroto in 2006 and Sir Paul Nurse in 2007. Immensely distinguished as they are, and in spite of the fact that Paul Nurse is now president of the Royal Society, neither of them fits the establishment model of great and good. Harry Kroto, especially, would probably not mind being called a maverick. He won his Nobel with two other chemists for their discovery of the remarkable molecule Buckminster Fullerene, Buckyballs, consisting of 60 carbon atoms, C60. It has long been known that you can assemble an elegant, sphere-like shape from 20 hexagons and 12 pentagons. It's the truncated icosahedron of classical geometers. Soccer balls are often constructed in this way. It is also well known that carbon atoms link up with each other in a tinker toy-like way to form structures of indefinite size, of which the best known are graphite and diamond crystals. It was therefore a theoretical possibility that 60 carbon atoms might link arms to make a soccer ball, a truncated icosahedron. It was almost too good to be true when that possibility was realised in the lab by Harry Kroto and his colleagues. Harry named the molecule Buckminster Fullerene after the visionary architect Buckminster Fuller, whom I met in his 90s, by the way, as a fellow speaker at a strange conference in France, where he held the audience spellbound for 3 hours. Bucky invented the geodesic dome, a stable structure whose resemblance to C60 was spotted by Harry Kroto. Amazingly, buckyballs have turned up in meteorites. Even more amazingly, buckyballs, though gigantic compared with quanta, behave like quanta in the famously counterintuitive two-slit experiment. Presumably, nobody has been quixotic enough to try it with golf balls, but that aside is surely straying absurdly too far aside. Harry Kroto's Simonia lecture was a passionate plea to save the Enlightenment and rescue rational thinking, and he unexpectedly launched a thundering broadside against the Templeton Foundation. This was music to my ears. He went further in his denunciation than I would ever have dared. He illustrated the lecture with examples of his wonderful series of educational resources, small films that science teachers can use. I met him again at the second Starmus conference, where he was as stimulating as ever, and well deserved his standing ovation. I think he was the only lecturer at the conference to get one. Incidentally, Harry's Starmus lecture, like his Simonia lecture, was a tour de force of PowerPoint virtuosity, using a technique that anyone might do well to emulate. Like most lecturers, I find that my lectures often draw from the same modular groups of slides, but different modules in each lecture. It is wasteful to duplicate the same slides every time you put together a presentation. The sensible strategy, one that would occur to any computer programmer, is to have only one copy of each slide, or modular group of slides, and call it every time you need it in different lectures. Harry is the only person I know who actually does this, and does it properly, so that each lecture is simply a collection of pointers to units which are stored elsewhere on his hard disk. Annoyingly, it is not possible to do this in Keynote, which is Apple's otherwise superior rival to PowerPoint. I have repeatedly tried to persuade Apple to implement subroutine jump hyperlinks instead of absolute jumps. The point about subroutine jumps is that they remember where they came from and return there. This is essential for the Croto ploy. I cannot see that subroutine jumps should be any more difficult to implement than the absolute jumps that are already there. And shouldn't be. Absolute jumps are notoriously bad programming practice anyway. I met Paul Nurse a couple of times when he was still at Oxford, running in Port Meadow, for instance, but I didn't have a long conversation with him until April 2007, when I won the Lewis Thomas Prize given by Rockefeller University in New York. Paul, as president of the university, hosted me when I travelled over to receive it. I was especially pleased to receive this prize, as Lewis Thomas was a much-admired lyrical stylist among biologists, a prose poet. Paul was a delightfully informal and friendly president, the sort of man you can't help instantly liking and continuing to like. He told me the strange story of his birth, which has now become well known, but which he had then only just uncovered. The woman whom he had thought to be his mother was actually his grandmother, and the woman whom he had thought to be his big sister was in fact his mother. Both had died while still maintaining the pretense. Paul seemed more amused than shocked by his recent discovery of his true origins, although he said it did take a bit of getting used to. What strange quirks of fate, I wondered, lead to the uncovering of genius from unexpected beginnings? How many geniuses remain undiscovered for lack of opportunity? How many Ramanujans have died unrecognized? How many talented women in Islamic theocracies are reduced to uneducated serfdom? Paul Nurse, like Harry Croto, is far from an establishment figure, and I suggested to him that he would consequently make an ideal president of the Royal Society in succession to Martin Rees. He hinted discreetly that it might be a possibility. I am delighted that it did indeed come to pass in 2010. 3 years earlier, his Simony lecture in 2007, The Great Ideas of Biology, was already the kind of magisterial survey you would expect a president of the Royal Society to give, a little reminiscent, but of course up-to-date, which makes a big difference in modern biology, of Peter Medawar's 1963 presidential address to the British Association. At the end of Other Men's Flowers, a charming and surprising, for a field marshal, anthology of poems, most of which he had had in memory at one time or another, Lord Wavell inserted his own little wayside dandelion, his Sonnet for the Madonna of the Cherries, whose final rhyming couplet, coming in the wake of the three sensitive quatrains, moves me deeply despite its Christian tenor. For all that loveliness, that warmth, that light, blessed Madonna, I go back to fight. I quote Field Marshal Wavell here only for the becoming modesty of his apology for including his own poem in such company. I felt the same diffidence when I decided that I myself should give the final Simony lecture of my tenure. I was conscious that I had never given an inaugural lecture, as new professors are supposed to do. This was technically because, as explained before, I was initially appointed Simony reader and only later became Simony professor. In practice, I thought of my Dimbleby lecture as filling the role of inaugural, but that was given on national television rather than in an Oxford hall. So I decided that I would make good the omission by giving a valedictory lecture in the Oxford Playhouse, and that it would be the final Simony lecture of my run, my wayside dandelion outside the garden of the Distinguished Nine. As part of my presentation, I showed pictures of all the Simony lecturers with the titles of their lectures. In my own lecture, called The Purpose of Purpose, I made a distinction between two meanings of purpose. I defined neo-purpose as true, deliberate human purpose, as in creative design, purpose as in goal and ambition. And I defined archipurpose as its ancient predecessor, the pseudo-purpose mocked up by Darwinian natural selection. My thesis was that neo-purpose is itself a Darwinian adaptation with its own archipurpose. Like other Darwinian adaptations, it has its limitations, and I illustrated its dark side, but also its huge virtues and breathtaking possibilities. I hope Charles Simony appreciated my instituting this series of lectures in his honour, and I'm glad that my successor, Marcus de Sautoy, is continuing the tradition. I was gratified that Charles made every effort to fly in each year, including 1999, when Dan Dennett was the first lecturer of the series. On that occasion, at the post-lecture dinner, I proposed the health of both Dan and Charles. The full text of what I said can be found in the E-Appendix, but I'd like to close this chapter as I drew to the close of my speech. It is incredible to think that I'm now in my fourth year as the Simony Professor. I can't tell you how fortunate I feel in this position, and therefore how grateful to Charles for his generosity, not just on behalf of myself, but on behalf of the university, for it is, I don't need to remind you, an endowment in perpetuity to a university with which Charles had no previous connection. In perpetuity means that we only have to put up with me for another 10 years before we get a new Simone professor. But Charles has also, during that time, become a really good personal friend to Lalla and me, and a good colleague, for we talk a great deal about science and the world of the mind, and I find myself continually learning from him and sharpening my arguments in discussion with him. I think of Charles as a sort of intellectual James Bond. He lives life to the full, and he won't mind my saying that he lives it in the fast lane. He loves gadgets and fast cars, pilots his own helicopter and his own jet planes, both the supersonic and the ordinary kind. But the conversation you're likely to have with him in the helicopter or the speedboat is not at all what you would expect from James Bond. It is much more likely to be about the nature of consciousness, or the singular beginning of time, the principle of free speech, or the hope for a grand unified theory of everything. Charles has now stayed with us in our home 4 or 5 times, and it's always a delight to have him. We visited Seattle slightly less often, mainly because of our relative lack of Learjets and Falcons. But we did attend his memorable housewarming party in his unprecedentedly memorable house. Villa Simone is one of the most imaginatively planned buildings I've ever seen. The glass walls abutting at unbelievable angles, the ultra-modern architecture, the perfect backdrop to the Vasarely paintings and the wall-to-wall computer screen inside. I had occasion to mention this in a poem that I wrote for Charles's pyjama party, which I have unfortunately lost, and of which I can recall only this couplet. There's the finest champagne and the best from the deli. The walls are of glass when they're not Vasarely. We unfortunately had to miss last year's party for his 50th birthday, but it was possible to imagine what it was like and attend it in spirit, in the form of a little verse that I composed in honour of the occasion. I should explain that this happened to coincide with the publication of my book, Unweaving the Rainbow, which is about Keats and Newton, science and poets. Never mind about John Keats or Newton's scientific feats. Forget your William Butler Yeats, William Wordsworth, William Gates. Never mind about unweaving. Here's a man beyond believing. Here's a man so smart and swift he penetrates Mach 2 at 50. And that's not all he'll penetrate. Even Windows 98 is not beyond his understanding. Happy takeoff, happy landing. See his supersonic plane go vanishing right through the rainbow. Unweaving the Threads from a Scientist's Loom. My 12 books have punctuated my decades, and their research, composition and revision have dominated my waking thoughts. But since they are all available to be read, it seems pointless in an autobiography to plod through them one by one, summarising each and then turning to the next. I've already mentioned the titles, more or less chronologically, in the context of my relationships with agents and publishers. If I now descry various themes that recur throughout my books, I don't mean it to sound grandiose when I hope that these themes, taken together, might add up to a kind of biologist's worldview, with an aspiration, at least, to coherence. Chronology will be only loosely in evidence as I trace each theme through the books in which it is serially developed and try to look back to its original entry into my life.